You are listening to Powder Radio. Brought to you by Powder Magazine. Welcome to Sponsored. I'm your host, Mike Powell, and this week we have the Godfather on the program. Yes, I am talking about Mike Douglas, the founder of the 1080, a member of the new Canadian Air Force, and a guy who's been on Solomon for almost 20 years. Let's see what Mike has to say about the history of twin tips and how they changed the world of skiing forever. Just get back from vacation?
Did, yeah.
So Hawaii?
Hawaii, yeah.
And how was it?
It was good. I mean, it was short. I was only there for 5 days. And then, of course, the election happened early on in that, which kind of sucks the wind out of your vacation sails a little bit.
Yep.
But we rallied and it turned out to be pretty good. We squeezed a lot into our time there.
Do you do this every year before the season to just get some time with the family?
Generally, yeah. We try to go in this sort of early November window. This year got a little bit more crimped. We usually try to do like at least a week, maybe 10 days at this time of year.
Okay.
And this year we had the Banff Film Festival last weekend. And then I'm leaving tomorrow morning for the little mini film tour starting in New York tomorrow. So.
And that's for Guilt Trip?
Yep.
And that's the new film that I guess you're entering in all the film festivals now?
Yeah, we actually have three that we are, but Guilt Trip's the big one that we're kind of hyping the most.
And that looks at glaciers and climate change and is also an amazing trip for you?
Yeah, more or less. It started as a ski expedition. And as the title sort of gives away, we were looking at the amount of resources and costs and various levels to get to where we wanted to go skiing. And we're like, whoa, this is pretty crazy. You know, I wonder if there's a way that we can sort of find a way to offset this at least, or do something positive for the world besides just going skiing. And so that's where Alan, our climate scientist, came in.
And he seemed like an interesting fellow. I saw that trailer for it and he just seemed like an out there kind of fun scientist that probably fit right into your program.
Alan was amazing. Like the coolest scientist in the world for sure. And so, yeah, it worked out great. He's an incredible guy.
I love how he called you guys out right away in the teaser with, you guys seem like you're a bunch of privileged skiers.
Yep. He nailed it right away. And he's a super smart guy. And we were so lucky to have him join us.
And when you came back from the trip, put all the footage together, realized all that you learned, was it a sobering experience of the data that came out of the trip?
I wouldn't say it was sobering because I follow climate science pretty closely.
Sure.
I would say it was affirming.
Okay.
It affirmed what I had already feared and knew. Seeing it firsthand, obviously, with a true expert that makes his life out of studying these type of things, and seeing it and touching it and understanding it from a real visceral, intimate level, certainly takes that up a notch. But yeah, I mean, it wasn't a revelation for me. I think it may have been for some of the other guys on the trip.
Okay.
But for me personally, not as much.
We're all invested in climate change. We all affect it. And the election, it's a big blow to climate change. I know you're on vacation and you didn't want it to ruin your vacation, but thoughts of the future of the world?
Well, like a lot of people, I felt sick.
Yeah.
I literally physically felt sick. I think like a lot of people, I felt like with the climate movement in particular, I felt like we'd kind of crested the hill.
Yep.
And people were finally coming on board and realize, like, to me, the debate was over. There was no, is climate change happening and is it caused by humans? That debate ended to me. Well, for me personally, that ended many, many years ago. But I thought within society as a whole that debate ended last year with the Paris Agreement.
Yep.
And to see the Trump win was, man, that was tough. You know, it makes you wonder, like, what are we all doing and what's the point of anything and what's the future? It certainly has opened a lot of question marks and places that we hoped we'd never have to consider.
I think sick is a way a lot of people felt. There's been a lot of blood, sweat, and tears put into making people aware of climate change and that it's actually happening. And now this is a step backwards.
Yeah.
But speaking about stepping backwards, let's start at where you started your ski career. So where were you born and raised, and what was childhood like for a young Mike Douglas?
Well, I was actually born in Saskatchewan, Canada, which is like being born in Kansas, I guess, is equivalent in the U.S. The same spot that Mark McMorris is from, actually, the snowboarder. So funny enough, but I have no memory of that place because my family moved out to B.C., to Vancouver Island, when I was like 2.
Okay.
And so I grew up mostly on Vancouver Island, never discovered skiing until it was a grade 5 school trip.
Wow.
I was living in a little town called Campbell River, fishing town, about an hour from this sort of local ski hill called Mount Washington on Vancouver Island, mm-hmm. and got to go on a grade 5 school trip, went up there, felt that sensation of sliding on snow and sort of the adventure that came with that of cruising down this forested run that did this big long turn and wondering what was coming up around the corner. And I was like, this is the coolest thing ever. And pretty much from that first day, to me, that was the ultimate. And that's all I wanted to do.
And your parents weren't into skiing at all?
Not at that point. They had been, you know, before they had us kids when they lived back east in Canada.
Okay.
They skied for a couple of years, but they hadn't at that point for probably, you know, 15 years at least since they'd really skied. But when they saw my enthusiasm for it, they decided to get the whole family into it.
Nice. And brothers and sisters?
I have one sister, younger okay. sister. Yeah.
What other sports did you do growing up? You're probably doing other things up until grade 5.
Yeah, I mean, up to that point, I was really into hockey. I mean, every Canadian kid, I think, is immersed in hockey. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember we lived in this small town called Tofino, which is actually like the surf town of Canada now.
Yeah.
And I actually lived there for a couple of years in the 70s, kind of before surfing. I remember I saw surfers there once in the 2 years I lived there. And we got one TV channel in Tofino at that time. And it was fuzzy at best, but... It was the CBC, and every weekend there was hockey on in the evening, and that's kind of all I remember seeing. And in the little town of Tofino, we didn't even have an ice rink, but we had a gymnasium that we had a floor hockey league, so I played a little bit of that. And then when we moved to Campbell River, which happened actually that year I went into grade 5, skiing became it right away. And also BMX bike. That was the other thing. I really loved BMX and raced for a little bit, but found that BMX freestyle was my thing. I even had like a quarter pipe in my backyard. I was super into it.
Nice. So grade 5, you get into skiing, and are you going skiing every weekend or is as often as your parents will take you?
It was pretty much a weekends thing. You know, I would have loved to gone more. As much as possible, for sure. But every weekend, starting with going out with my parents. And I remember the stress in those early years. I wanted to be on the first lift, like every morning. I wanted to be standing at the chair before it started turning. And everyone else in my family didn't really care. They were right. Like, oh, let's make a pancake breakfast this morning. I'm like, are you kidding me? It was tough for a few years because nobody really felt the urgency that I did. But when I reached the age where my friends could start driving, we'd leave the house at 7 a.m. to make sure we were up there ready to go for first lift. And my parents, they'd always tell the stories of having to sit in the car and wait for me at the end of the day because I would ski until the last lift. Like I would always try and squeeze one more out of the lifties, you know, at the end of the day. Yep. So I used to eat my lunch on the chair.
So it took over your life. When you're on the hill, everything else disappeared and it was just skiing and that's all you thought about.
Yep.
As you move forward and start, do you put into a program, a freestyle program, or do you race, or how does it kind of evolve? How does your career progress from just going every weekend in grade 5 and pissing your parents off by wanting to be first chair? And when did it start taking over as something that, hey, I'm going to do this and this is going to be my passion and I'm going to be able to grow as a skier?
You know, by the time I was probably 16, I think I would be considered a pretty good skier. I was skiing a lot with my buddy Kevin Fogelin, who, if you've seen the film Snowman, was my best friend at that time. And we also had these other buddies, Mark Gage and his brothers. And Mark's brother, Greg, was a pretty talented young photographer. And so we would start to go, you know, on the sunny days and whatever. Greg would bring his camera up and he would take pictures of us all doing jumps and hitting cliffs and pow turns and stuff like that. And I remember, I think I was 16, and Greg started submitting photos to Powder Magazine and just some local publications and stuff like that. And we started getting some photos published, which kind of like stoked me out. And at the same time, around that time, Greg Stump was just rising as a movie maker. And I remember like watching Warren Miller films and Greg Stump films and stuff like that. And I wanted to be Scott Schmidt. Like I thought Scott Schmidt was like the ultimate skier.
Yeah.
And so I never really had a desire to compete. but I just wanted to hit cliffs. I wanted to be able to rip the bumps. I wanted to be just kind of the best all-around skier I could be. And I really enjoyed the whole aspect of like shooting photos. And more than anything, I think what I liked about that was being able to freeze those moments, like those favorite moments of my life. A photo would freeze that, and then I could just stare at it all week while I wasn't skiing and kind of put myself back there.
Well, it's nice to know that that's for you. You're out there getting the photos, and it's not, I want to get them published. While that is really cool to have them published, it's nice to hear your perspective of freezing the moment and having that for yourself forever, which is a pretty cool way to look at that.
Yeah, for sure.
So you're 16, you're getting pretty good, you're getting some photos published. Have you started to go to the summer camps yet? Has that started on the glacier at Whistler?
I didn't even know about summer camps. You know, it sounds funny to say this now because the world is so small, but back then, like we were living on Vancouver Island, we were so isolated.
Yeah.
Like Powder Magazine was our connection to the outside world of skiing. Like you didn't know what was going on in Whistler. Like we'd heard of Whistler, but we didn't know like what happened there. We didn't know. I didn't know what it looked like. You know, I'd seen a picture or whatever, but I had no idea what existed. Actually, when I was 16, my parents, I convinced them to do like a road trip ski vacation through the States. And we picked ski resorts, the iconic ski resorts that we could drive to. We actually went to Sun Valley.
Okay.
And the conditions were terrible. So we only stayed there for one day because it was like so bad. And then we drove out to Mount Bachelor and we spent the rest of the week there. And that was a really cool trip. For me, that was like the first time I'd really skied outside of kind of my area and kind of opened my eyes up a little bit to bigger mountains. And then when I graduated from high school, I wanted to ski and my buddy Kevin went off to Whistler.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt this like super strong responsibility that I needed to go to school and at least get like a year of university under my belt before I did anything fun. So I did that. And then literally like that year in university was torture.
Uh-huh.
I just wanted to be in the mountains so bad. So I convinced my parents the next year, like wanted to take a year off and go skiing. And I did. The next year I moved to Whistler, 1988, and got to Whistler. And, you know, my attitude was, I just want to make the most of this experience because it's only going to last for 6 months or whatever.
Right.
At that time I was thinking I was going to get skiing out of my system. Like it's kind of taken over my life and all my thought patterns and everything. So let's just immerse myself in it and I'll kind of blast it out of myself. Then I can get on with life and be a responsible person.
Yep.
So I got here in Whistler and I contacted the local photographer who was getting shots published and said, hey, you know, if you're looking for someone to ski for you, I'd love to be involved. I started doing like the local race circuit. I met a couple of really good freestylers, Lane Barrett, B. Thomas, who were the best bump rippers on the mountain, John Smart. They got me into mogul competitions and I just did everything that winter and had like the best year of my life by far. By the end of the season, it was like the whole freestyle skiing thing, like moguls and aerials. I ended up top three in both moguls and aerials for BC at the end of the season.
Whoa, in your first year?
Yeah. Yeah. And I was like, whoa. And people, you know, I started meeting like people from the national team and coaches and all this stuff. And they're like, yeah, man, you got talent. You could do pretty good at this. And I was like, cool. So I actually did leave Whistler that next spring and was planning to go back to school, but I was late. It actually was an accident. I didn't do it intentionally, but I was late registering for my classes for that next fall semester. And in the end, I couldn't do the stuff in school that I was interested in. And I would have had to just take a bunch of stuff that I didn't want to take. And I was paying for it myself. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to school if I can't take what I wanted to take.
Yeah.
So I told my parents, I'm like, well, I'm going to go back to Whistler for another year because I've got this competition stuff going on now, which I kind of convinced them, like, you know, I could make it to the national team and maybe even, who knows, maybe even the Olympics one day. And so I went back to Whistler and it was awesome.
And what do your parents think at this point in knowing you? And I don't know you super well, but enough to where you seem like a very humble, responsible, all around good dude. And your parents probably look at you as, oh, our son, Mike, he's a great kid. He's responsible. He's going to school. He took a year off and he's going to go back. And then when you tell them you're not going back, are they concerned?
I don't think they were, because I was giving them a good sales pitch. I went down the road of, hey, here's an opportunity for me to make the national team in skiing. And, you know, and I told them, I'm like, I can always go to school. Why don't I do this and just see where it goes and I can go to school. And also at the time, like, you know, my parents were pretty modest income family, working class sort of family. And I was paying for everything too.
Okay.
My parents weren't paying for my school or anything. I was working my ass off all summer trying to make that work. So it wasn't really a drain on them. And I think they trusted me and they were like, okay, good. Well, good luck. Yeah. And so I went back to Whistler and I competed all the next year as a BC team member. And by the end of the season, I'd made it to the Canadian team. And then at that point, I went actually and did a one semester of university the following fall, but with the intention that I would just do the fall semester. And then I was out of there and going to go off, hit the mogul circuit.
When you make the team, these thoughts and dreams of what could happen that you're thinking at night when you're going to sleep, they actually start happening and you're like, holy shit, this could be my life and be my future. And while knowing you, I'm sure you're not 100% gung-ho, this is everything, because you probably have a backup plan for everything you do. But now is the plan, I'm going to make it in skiing and I'm going to go 110% forward and there's going to be no regrets.
Yeah, absolutely. And when that all started happening, I was like, okay, I got this opportunity. I've got coaches. Like, whoa, coach. I mean, I never had a coach before. And I didn't grow up with like Olympic dreams or anything like that. So I was in a really different place than most of the people around me who could have been competing since they were like 8 years old and been skiing since they were two.
Right.
I started everything late. And at this point, as a guy who just made the national team, I think I was 20 years old and I was already old. I was already like the old guy.
That's like the story of your career, right?
It's been the story of my entire career. It's hilarious. So it was a little different, but at the same time, I was super motivated and went fully, you know, tunnel vision mode and pretty much dedicated my life to trying to be the best mogul skier I could be for like 5 years.
And how far did that dedicating your life, how far did that get you in the world of moguls?
I was a Canadian team member. I think my best performances and results came fairly early on. I never won a major event, but I was a contender in a lot of them. I was an alternate for the Olympic team in 94, Lillehammer Olympics.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, so that was pretty cool. And what was cool about that too is we had the best team in the world. All the members of the team that went to Lillehammer were in the top six.
Wow.
So Canadian team dominated. Jean-Luc Brossard won. If you're going to be on a team and not quite make it, that was the team to be on.
Right. Do you go to the games for that?
I didn't know. I got fitted for the outfits and all that kind of stuff in the months before. But once the team left for the games, like they wouldn't sub you out the day before kind of thing. So it was like once the team had left and everyone was healthy, it was a done deal. But the crazy thing was all of us on the team were in a van literally 2 weeks before the Olympics. We were driving from Montreal to Lake Placid, New York in this classic Northeast blizzard, super icy highway. And we hit a patch of ice. Pretty sure John Smart was driving. And van goes sideways on the interstate. And we smash into like one of those underpasses, straight into the side, and almost got completely obliterated by a semi that couldn't stop. Yeah, the whole team was in this van that crashed on the highway. We were all okay.
Wow.
That was like 2 weeks before the Olympics.
And the alternate too. You would have been screwed.
Yeah, I was in the front seat. I was actually in the seat that hit the cement barrier.
Jesus.
Yeah.
How were you as a competitor? Did you care about getting first place? Were you happy to be there? Or what did you feel like when it was time for you to drop in?
I was known as a bit of a head case, honestly. I was the guy who would like just own it and practice and then make one little mistake in his competition round. And it became really frustrating for me. So in like the last year or two of my career, it was tough. And then I got injured the Olympics year, right after the Olympics. Actually, I went off to finish off the final comps of the year and kind of tried to decide what I was going to do moving forward. You know, once moguls became an Olympic discipline, like all these things, your whole life turns into these 4 year cycles.
Yeah.
And I ended up breaking my ankle about a month after the Olympics. And I just was like, you know what? I don't want to do this for 4 more years. And the other thing was I was self-funding. And at that point, you know, there were 3 or 4 guys on the team that were better than me. And there's only a certain amount of funding that goes around.
Yep.
I was working my ass off all summer to try and pay for it all winter. After 5 years, I did that. I was just tired of being broke. Constantly being broke. And so I decided that I was going to stop mogul skiing and I wanted to stay in Whistler. I wanted to stay in the mountains. I looked at going back to school. Actually, when I had my broken ankle, I used it as an opportunity. I went back and spent a week in Vancouver with my buddy Kevin, who was going to UBC at the time. And I got back to school and I was like, you know what? There's nothing I want to do here. You know, I've been living in Whistler now at that point for 5 years. And I was like, I just want to live in Whistler and find a way to make it work there. And so I started coaching the local freestyle club here, kind of became the main mogul coach and did that for a couple of years. And then, you know, our team had really good success in those 2 years. I got actually offered a job with the Canadian team to be one of the mogul coaches, kind of bringing the new guys up to speed.
Okay.
that were just getting on the team. And it was at that point I met J.P. Eau Claire, J.F. Cousin, and Vinnie Dorion.
And that's when it all started? That's the beginning of the new school?
Yeah, I mean, to a certain degree, it was already kind of happening because Shane Zox and I had become really good friends in those previous couple of years. And, you know, Shane and I, as skiers, we just had the exact same attitude. Like, we were mogul skiers, but we were very much kind of free riders or free skiers in our minds. Once mogul skiing made its debut in the Olympics, it really started getting regimented and kind of robotic.
For sure.
A lot of what attracted me to it in the beginning was gone. And for guys like Shane and I, like, yeah, we would train moguls in the traditional way, and then we'd go out and hit jumps up at the top of the mountain, some big windlip or whatever, and we started doing tricks. We were kind of like poaching what was called the snowboard park.
Right.
There was no terrain park. It was only snowboard parks back in the mid-90s. We'd poach those on our skis and get chased out of there by snowboarders and ski patrol and whatever. I guess thinking back now, it really started that year that JP, JF, and Vinny came onto the team. And I was the coach and Shane was on the team as well. And basically when training was done for the day, Shane and JP, JF, Vinny, and I would all take off and go either to the snowboard park or to just find some jump on the mountain and try and do silly tricks.
And this is what, 96?
Yeah, that would be 96 when it all started. 97 was the first ever shoot we'd done as a group. It was actually with Greg Stump for his movie called Fistful of Moguls.
Mm-hmm.
And we did this windlip session with Stumpy. And for me, like, I landed my first ever Misty Flips that day. JP was throwing these big 720 combos and just big spins with grabs. And Shane, same thing. And that was really like the first time. And people, when we started doing this stuff for real, you know, people started noticing pretty quick. And it was the same year that we met Johnny DeCesare as well. Shane actually met him at the SIA show in Vegas that year, and they hit it off. And then about a month after that shoot with Greg Stump, Johnny came up to Whistler and we started working on his film called State of Mind.
Mm-hmm.
Made with two VCRs, VHS.
Yeah. So crazy how that used to be done.
Yeah.
At this point, are you kind of looking at your gear and it's not really functional for the skiing that you want to start doing?
Yeah, exactly. So it actually started in a different way a little bit. It started less from the necessity of gear and more from the death of popular mogul skiing.
Okay.
Up to this point, because I was good mogul skiers on the Canadian team, all this kind of stuff, in Japan, mogul skiing was huge in the late 80s and through the 90s. And I was getting paid by my ski sponsor at the time, Nisel Dockstein, to ski. And so I'd go over and with a handful of other people, and we'd do demos in Japan. Mogul demos. I was making mogul videos at the time.
Huh.
It's a lot of how to ski moguls. And funny enough, you know, I'd never really let anyone know this, but I was actually not only skiing in the videos, I was already directing them and editing them and everything.
So the precursor to Switchback Entertainment was how-to videos in Japan.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
And did you have patches on your knees at all times in that era?
All times.
Okay.
Let's be clear. Yeah. At all times.
Okay. Just making sure.
Yeah. And so what happened was I'd been making about half my income through all these sponsors I had in Japan that were paying the bills and I was doing demos for and videos and all this kind of stuff. And it was fall 96. They came to me and said, hey, oh, business is so bad in Japan. This will have to be the last year of your contract. And I was like, oh, okay. Which was super cool of them because they basically gave me almost a year's warning.
That's amazing.
That my contract was going to expire, which was amazing because it gave me time to go, okay, what am I going to do now? Try and come up with a plan. At the same time as I hear this news and go, okay, well, I've got to figure out what I'm going to do and how I'm going to make a living. We start doing all these funky tricks on skis. And I had a dinner with a friend of mine who was one of my coaches on the Canadian team, who is now coaching the Japanese mogul team, Steve Faring. And Steve's like, you know, Japan, the ski industry is tanking. Mogul skiing's dying. They're looking for something new. He was working with Solomon in Japan at the time. And he's like, you know, what about this new stuff you guys are doing? Like, is there a ski that you guys could make that would make make this better? And I'm like, yeah, totally. Like, we need a twin tip. We need something we can go backwards on. We need something that's like wider platform that's got a carving profile. I mean, keep in mind, we're skiing on like 73 mil waisted like swords.
Right.
Basically, mogul skis have no side cut. Like, they're just designed for going straight through moguls, basically. And so Steve's like, well, why don't you guys put together some ideas and I'll try and shop them around for you in Japan. And so for the next 2 months after that meeting, we worked on putting together the original air carving video. And I wrote up like a 20-page proposal about why this was good business for a ski company and all this stuff. And in August 97, Steve started shopping it around to all the ski companies in Japan. I mean, he took it to Salomon first because that was sort of the connection he had.
Yep.
But we were like, well, let's not limit it to one brand. Like, let's shop it around and see what happens. And long story short, pretty much every brand slammed the door in his face. It was like, this is stupid. It's never going to work. You guys are wasting your time. You're wasting our time. There was only two brands in the end that saw a little bit of something in it. One was Salomon and the other was Rossignol, actually.
Huh.
And so fast forward of 2 or 3 months, Rossignol ended up going, well, we think there's something here. We believe in you guys. You're awesome skiers, but we don't want to develop a product with you. They had these little like 140 centimeter little twin tip skis. Can't even remember what the name was on them. And they said, here, we'll give you these and you can be a part of the Rossignol team. And we're like, no. I was like, you guys are missing the point. Like, this isn't the point. We're not looking for just a ski sponsor. We're trying to make something here. And then like Shane Zox got kind of cold feet at that point. He was like looking at going into the winter without any ski sponsor. And the idea of paying for skis was complete crap. So
Shane was part of that program too with you guys.
Yeah. Shane was part of the original. He kind of jumped ship when it looked like it wasn't going anywhere. So Shane's like, you know, K2, they just launched this ski called the Poacher and they've offered me a spot on their K2 free ride team and I'm going to go for it. And I was like, yeah, I get it, you know. And so it came down to then it was just me and the three French boys. And I was like literally had pretty much given up. Like I was at the very end of thinking that it could be possible because, you know, skiing was starting. The mountains were opening. It was, you know, it was mid to late November.
Yep.
And then I got a call from a guy at Salomon in Canada, actually named Mingo. And he gave me like the best pep talk ever, like an hour on the phone. Like, I saw your idea. It's been getting talked about inside Salomon all over the world. And man, I think this is brilliant. I think you guys are going to totally change skiing. And you just got to believe. He's like, give us some time. Give us some time. There's some people in this company that don't believe in it, but we're working on them and we think it might happen. And I was like, okay. So it kind of like revived me again. And then I think it was only about 2 weeks after that and we got the call. And it was like, Salomon was like, yep, we want it. We're going to go for it. We're going to work with you guys. Let's make this ski. Let's make it happen. And we were like, whoa, this is awesome. Funny part next was they wanted the designs for the ski because I'd actually made like physical designs for the ski. And I was like, no, I'm not giving you the designs for the ski until we have a contract.
Smart.
And they're like, well, okay. And I'm like, yeah, get us a contract and then we'll fork over the design. So they thought they knew what we wanted. The first protos were like the biggest joke you've ever seen. They were these hyper carving skis with like 40 mil side cut or something stupid. They were like 130 centimeters long. They had no twin tip. We just looked at them and we're like, this is the stupidest thing we've ever seen. Are you guys crazy? And so we realized that we had a lot of work to do. And so while I didn't give them the designs, we started telling them, no, it's got to be more like this. No, it's like this. No, it's like this, you know? And then it was about 2 months later, we were in Colorado for a Moguls World Cup in Breckenridge. And the next day was the first U.S. free skiing open in Vail.
Mm-hmm.
And I brought the boys over. Everyone competed on their mogul skis. JP won the big air, I think. Sean won the slope style. And we literally, like right after the event finished, we raced back to our hotel to get changed in Breckenridge. And in the lobby of the hotel waiting was a package with my name on it. And we opened it up and it was the first ever yellow 1080. And we opened that box and we're like, holy crap, this is the coolest thing we've ever seen. Yeah. Looks like they got it right. So we literally were in our hotel for like 15 minutes to get changed, grabbed the ski, raced back over to Vail. Actually, we kept the ski in the box. We raced over to Vail. The awards were up at the top of the mountain. We had to take the gondola up, brought our box with us, kept the box kind of hidden in the corner of the room. And then when JP got announced to come up to win big air, he carried the ski up and held it above his head. And no one had ever seen it before. And it was just like this moment where everyone was like, oh my God, what is that?
Yeah.
So it was pretty cool.
That was the birth of free skiing, I heard, the birth of this round.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I mean, if there was a point in time, everyone who would become sort of the leaders for the decade following, they were all there. And that was the first time we'd met guys like Kreitler and McConkie and Shane Anderson and these kind of guys. Like, so it was like the first time that everyone kind of came together.
And was the vibe, could you feel the energy of like a new part of the sport evolving and you guys were the ground level of it?
Oh, totally. Yeah. There was so much buzz. Like it was, and it was all new to us too. So, I mean, I'm sure that had a little bit to do with it, but it certainly felt like there was something bigger going on than just like some personal stoke and hype. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And then in the next 3 years, the whole industry changes for the better. And I've seen some interviews with you before where you say that skiing was always cool and snowboarding didn't reignite skiing. But I feel like snowboarding just showed another element of what could be done on snow that ski technology hadn't caught up to yet. And you guys were the catch-up point where the technology was equal to what snowboarding had. And then you could do the tricks that they could do, but you could just do them bigger and with all the advantages of ski technology.
Yeah, yeah, pretty much. I mean, there's no question that snowboarding was a catalyst to that movement. Skiing had sort of, through rules and regulations over the decades, had sort of stifled itself down. And when snowboarding came in, there were a bunch of punk kids that didn't give a shit.
Right.
And that was the attitude that was kind of needed to sort of change everything and shake it up. We loved the attitude. We were just like, yeah, but let's do this on skis, you know? And it was kind of like the rebirth of the 70s. Freestyle,
yeah,
where anything kind of went. Mm-hmm. It was pretty fun.
And at that point in the next 3 years, everybody who's at that contest that first year becomes a full-on rock star within the ski world with their different sponsors. Skiing realized that this was the way to market skiing and make it cool again, and they went in 100% behind this type of athlete. I would think the trips, the pay, and everything that comes along with being a rock star in the ski world, it just started happening.
Exactly, yeah.
And for you, what was the best of those times?
There was a few times in the next, yeah, say a couple of years after that, where it was kind of like, you can't believe that this is really happening. And one of those times was, you know, we went to the X Games for the first time and ESPN embedded a camera crew into our lives. Like we were like doing reality TV basically before reality TV. Huh. We'd wake up and there'd be a camera crew sitting there filming us and filming Kusan just as a complete disaster in the corner,
right,
hungover from the night before. And that was one. I remember we were doing a photo shoot that later that spring up in Whistler too. And we were on this quarter pipe, kind of natural quarter pipe at Whistler. The shots have been seen. Anyone who was around in that area has seen shots from it. But there was five different camera crews, film crews there.
Wow.
Everyone from Johnny and Poor Boys, Matchstick, TGR, Warren Miller, and there was a TV crew, and it was just like every direction you looked, there were cameras, and it was like, whoa.
That's crazy, because if you go back 3 years, you could get cameras to come up to film skiing.
No, exactly. Yeah. Skiing was dead. I don't think the kids today realize, if you weren't around at that time and deeply involved in skiing, realize like how bleak it was to be a young skier and how you were just so uncool.
Yep.
So it felt like a big deal. And I remember like same thing going over to Japan after all this stuff started blowing up. Kusan was a rock star. Like I remember having to sneak Kusan out of a ski lodge. We had to sneak him out through the kitchen because there were so many screaming girls waiting to get his autograph and touch him.
That is crazy.
Yeah, it was awesome. It was like, whoa, man, we're rock stars. This is crazy. Yeah, this is good times.
And as the industry evolves, it's taken the technology that you guys put together and they keep evolving it, but it's still that twin tip technology and a wider platform underfoot just to adapt the style of skiing that you and the forefathers of free skiing brought to the table. And now you can take that type of skiing into the backcountry just because of the products that were built and inspired by you guys.
I mean, I guess the big innovative years in skiing started a couple of years before this, probably like 93, 4, 5, somewhere in there where the shape skis,
yep,
came into the mix. And we kind of like built on top of that, and then fat skis built on top of that, and then rocker skis built on top of that. So it was a really exciting decade and a half for ski technology. I mean, when you looked at what we were skiing on in the early 90s and you look what you ski on in the 2005 to 2010, you're like, whoa, completely different experience.
How involved are you with Salomon in developing skis these days?
Pretty involved. It kind of goes in waves. You know, there's a handful of skis over the years that have certainly my fingerprints all over them. The first was the 1080. And then after that, the Pocket Rocket was something I had a lot to do with.
Mike, you've made them a lot of money. Just those two skis right there.
Yeah, I feel okay about still being a sponsored skier with Salomon. I feel like they've gotten good value out of me.
Yeah, you've earned your keep.
Yeah, I went on a big drought, though, after the Pocket Rocket. I had a little bit of involvement in the gun and foil, but not a lot in the design. And then the next big one where I was really in the trenches was the original Rocker 2.
Okay.
And I literally sketched out that whole tip and tail honeycomb stuff.
Okay.
I sketched that on a piece of paper. I'll never forget it. I was in a pub in Whistler and we were talking about this new ski. And I was like, the biggest thing at the time for me was weight. You know, skis had gotten super fat.
Yep.
And they were getting heavy. And it's like, how can we pull weight out of it? And, you know, Dav was working with Kesley and they had those little windows in the tip and
yep.
tail. And I was like, we need something like that, but something different, obviously. And then I worked with a ski engineer named Aldrich and literally sketched out this honeycomb tip and tail. Because on a rockered ski, we were like, well, the only time a rockered ski tip and tail is making contact in the snow is when it's powder.
Yep.
Because if you're on hard pack, your effective edge is actually pretty short. And so we're like, well, you don't need the strength up in the tip and tail the way you do with a traditional ski. So let's pull that weight out of there. And it was one of those funny things. I mean, the Rocker 2 had reasonable success, but then Rosignol came out and just did a way better job of showing that technology, copied our technology and did a way better job of showing it.
They put those lights on the tips in the windows at stores,
exactly.
Man, and it just crushed it.
I was so pissed because I had this shop guy tell me how Rosignol just invented this mind-blowing technology. And this is like 2 years after we'd done it with Salomon. And I was just like, oh, man.
I mean, that ski's what's kept them in business. So they should thank you as well.
Yeah. they've definitely crushed it. They told that story just way better than anyone else. Props to them for that, for sure.
Your relationship with Salomon has really blossomed. Now you're less of a pro skier and more of a filmmaker, but you're both. You're able to produce and direct films with Salomon and Switchback Entertainment and then also star in those films. That's got to be a dream come true. A lot more work than you ever imagined having to do, but you're probably able to plan out and create the best trips of your life.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's... Yeah, it has been a dream come true. I'm celebrating, I believe this week, my 19th year with Salomon.
Wow.
Which I'm pretty stoked on. And as a matter of fact, kind of breaking news, not that anyone cares, but I just signed another 2-year deal like literally 2 weeks ago with them.
You will be 21 on Salomon or 21 years on Salomon. That is guaranteed.
Yeah. Well, it seems so. Yeah. Guarantees are something I'm trying not to ever really say in this world because things are so wacky. But yeah, it appears as though that will be the case. Yeah.
Well, congratulations on that.
Thanks. Yeah. No, I mean, I never, ever, ever imagined that in my late 40s, I could still be a sponsored professional skier. That's something that it still blows me away even to think about it, actually.
There's a lot of things that blow me away about your career, but one thing that I think of was there was an event back in probably 2004 or 5. It was called the Back Nine, and it was an event
2006.
Where, 2006. I'm looking at the ski right now with your autograph next to me. But this is an event where the best skiers in the world were invited to the Whistler backcountry, and there were 9 different holes or features per se, and skiers voted on each other in a golf-style format. And the winner was Mike Douglas, who happened to be probably 5 years older than anybody else in the contest. It was just amazing to see your skills on snow at 35 at that point were blowing away the 23-year-olds out there, and it's a tribute to what you've been able to do.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
That event was a capper for my competitive career. You know, the whole backcountry freestyle thing was something that I got into pretty early on, you know, with the development of the Pocket Rocket. That largely came from me kind of wanting to be out, honestly, in the soft snow and in Whistler backcountry more than anything because I was old and the terrain parks were just crushing my back.
Yeah.
And at 30 years old, already at that point, my ability to just hammer park laps all day was already diminished. And I also just loved being out in the natural terrain. And so that whole concept of the Back Nine competition was sort of like, that's where I was most comfortable and where I thought the sport had been heading for a while. And then to win that event was... that still is probably my, when I look back to like my competitive career, that would probably still be the highlight, because that was kind of the culmination of everything that I built myself towards as a skier. And I decided to call my competitive career quits after that. I was like, it's never going to get better than this for me. So that was the last contest I ever did.
Mike, I want to thank you for your time. There's a lot of interesting stuff that you had to share that I had no idea that happened, especially the founding of the 1080. I thought that Zox was less involved on your side and more involved on the K2 side. I found out he wasn't involved on the K2 side. He was totally with you guys and then jumped ship when he didn't know if Solomon was going to happen. So that was an interesting piece of knowledge I picked up, and I want to thank you for that and really everything that you've done in your career. And I encourage everyone to look at Free Ski TV. It's got Mike's fingerprints all over it, and it's pretty amazing stuff.
Thank you.
So that was time with Mike Douglas, and wow, he made a ton of money for Solomon with the Pocket Rocket, the 1080, and the Rocker 2. And we will have more Mike Douglas over on the Powell Movement with Inappropriate Questions. As always, if you have any feedback for me, you can reach me at mike@thepowellmovement.com or on Twitter at PowellMovement1. I want to thank you for tuning in. It's time to break out those rock skis, and I will talk to you next week.